Hello and welcome to The Natural Selection. This week's theme is caves. Hello, welcome back. We are The Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
Nick.
Hello.
And I am Naomi. Hi guys, how are you doing this week?
I'm all right. I always really enjoy it when you host. When you introduce Nick, we can really tell whether you're pronouncing the K or not.
I know you can. I'm trying.
Never any hesitation or confusion.
No, it's always so clear and evident what I'm talking about. So have you guys had any nature interactions this week?
Well, only this. Nick, you know this because we live in the same city, and it's been very cold this week. It is colder, I think, this week than it was all last winter here. And yet, I opened my window to get some fresh air, and in flew the biggest house fly I've ever seen. Where did it come from? How does it survive in the cold winter? What did it live in that didn't freeze? And I guess my final question, is it homeothermic?
That's a lot of questions all at once.
Let me make it a little easier. What the heck is a fly doing in my house in midwinter?
Yeah, I suppose I never really think about house flies being kind of seasonal, because I guess they live in your house, so they can, it can be warm there.
But it had to grow up somewhere. It's massive. It's like the size of a small bird.
That feels like a slight exaggeration.
Well, I mean, the truth is, in cities there's a lot of sort of decaying material like bins and things which offer warmth, which could offer a lot of food as well. So it's probably just fresh off out of a bin, Nick, so don't worry.
Cool, great, fresh out of a Nikon bin. Welcome home.
I actually saw something really cool. I saw two cormorants.
Oh my god.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I went for a little walk. Near me, I'm right next to the Spray, and you can sort of walk around, and there's a bit where it's sort of, the Spray continues going, but there's a bit off the left, so there's not so much current, and there's loads of people park their boats there, and they've got these little islands in the middle. And there were two cormorants standing on a log, just staring at the water, and I was waiting for it, because obviously they look a lot like herons with that long neck, and I was waiting for it, because I think you guys were there once, weren't you? I think a day after university, we'd gone to the park. And we sat and watched herons hunt.
Yeah, I remember that. That was cool. Were the cormorants doing the wing thing?
They were literally waiting. They had their neck like bent in that S shape, waiting to sort of like spring out into the water. But I watched for a while, and one of them half went, and I thought, oh my god. But as Nick mentioned, it's exceptionally cold. And after a while, I gave up and went home and had a cup of tea.
Yeah, that sounds wise. Sounds wise. Yeah, I don't think I had any sort of nature interaction this week. I'm back to work, so I didn't get a chance to go out to the park or anything. It's been dark when I get up and dark when I go home, so don't really see too much these weeks. But hopefully next week it'll start to get brighter again, so might see some more stuff.
It'll start to get lighter on the shortest day of the year.
Cool. So shall we make a start with the news?
Sure.
Let's rock on.
So join us, listeners, after this short break, where we'll be back with the news. Welcome back. So I'm going to kick off this week's news with some interesting research that I found about pterosaurs. I thought this was fitting because I talked about pterosaurs a couple of episodes ago in our flight episode. So this was published in Nature, and they found the precursor to pterosaurs. So this was done using new technology on some recent specimens that have been found. So there was a couple of particular skulls that have been uncovered in North America, Brazil, Argentina, and Madagascar. And researchers have shown that this group, they were known as dinosaur precursors called lagerpetids, but they're actually the closest relatives of pterosaurs. So the group was first discovered in the 40s, and based on the bones that they discovered at the time, they had thought they were closer to dinosaurs. But because of this new research that they looked at and new technologies available, such as CT scanning, when they looked inside the brain cases, they realize that they're actually closer to pterosaurs. Another fascinating insight from this work is that this group of legger-patids have some of the same neuro and anatomical features that allow pterosaurs to fly. So this shed some light on the evolution of flight in pterosaurs, and that actually this was something that had evolved in their predecessors.
Ooh. Do you know, though, I think this means that something you said in a previous episode is wrong.
Oh, potentially.
Because that would mean, because I think back then we thought that, I think you say that the earliest vertebrate that had powered flight was a pterosaur.
Yes.
But this appears that it was actually there, is there something before it?
No, so this group couldn't fly.
Oh,
they just have the same anatomical features. But I guess in theory, there was something slightly before a pterosaur that could fly. But they haven't found that gap yet. But this is sort of a stepping stone towards helping them understand. Because there was quite a big gap between their closest known ancestor and the pterosaurs. So this helps kind of bridge that gap. But it also shows that they thought that maybe the pterosaurs had evolved very quickly. But this shows that they just had kind of normal speeds. They just thought that this group was slightly further away from them than it actually is.
Cool.
Yeah. So, Nick, I think you have something kind of troubling to tell us this week.
Yeah, I have some not so great news, but news that probably will come. I don't know. It's one of those news that those headlines that has a bit of like a, like, did you realize effect? At least on me, and I think you guys have seen this article as well that came out in Nature this week. It was done by a team of researchers working in Israel who basically were looking at production in like human society and our impact on the world and ways of quantifying and understanding the relationship between those different things. And the study, the headline is basically that human produced mass now exceeds the combined biomass of all life on Earth. Which is, I'll say it again. Human produced mass now exceeds the biomass of all living things on Earth combined. Which is, to give you a sense of the numbers involved here, we're talking, so this is a historical study. They looked at production of mostly things like plastic, concrete, metal, buildings, basically like the fabrication of materials over the course of the last 120 years or so, since the early 1900s. And they found that at the early 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, the total mass of human produced content on Earth was about 3% of the world's total biomass. And every 20 years, it's doubled. So over the course of the last 120 years, we're now at the point where that mass is about equivalent to 1.1 teratons. And teraton is not a word that I've encountered before. So I had to look that up. And
Is it related to pterosaurs?
It means horrifying. Oh, no, wait, that's dino. Sorry, it's the other way around. We talked about this before. No, it's the dino weight, the terrible weight of 1,000 trillion tons is the total weight of things on Earth that we've made, which exceeds the biomass of Earth now as of the past couple of years. So cool, horrifying. Some of the key things that they point out and sort of note here are that one of the spikes in this production happened right after the switch of production from using bricks as the primary material to concrete. That really helped us produce a lot more mass and buildings and things. And some of the dips where production lowered, it included the Great Depression and the 1979 oil crisis. And I don't think we have enough data yet, but I might hope that the last year, out of all the horrible things that have happened because of the coronavirus pandemic, that maybe we might see a dip in this. But the final thing I want to mention here, and really the thing that sort of hit me as really grim, is that over the last 100 years, we've halved the biomass of plants on Earth.
Whoopsie.
Wow, that's
a wrap.
So it's like double. We're increasing way too much stuff, and we're decreasing the good stuff that we want around. Wow, that is some upsetting news.
Another takeaway from this news is that between the Great Depression and the 1979 oil crisis, we got a lot worse at naming bad things.
That's true. Yeah, that's totally true. What is this now? The coronavirus pandemic? That's so bland.
Yeah, really jazz it up.
Oh, no. The what was 2008? The housing crisis?
The credit crunch.
God, that's so blah. the credit crunch. No, the Great Depression. Black Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I mean, they're not, but they're good names.
So, Nick, do you have something to improve the mood after that piece of news for us?
Well, I think depending on the listener, this will either make them happy or sad. Sad's a bit strong, but maybe terrified.
Yes, that's less strong.
There's a new snake.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah, it's in Vietnam. So don't panic yet unless you're going to North Vietnam. But it's a really, really interesting find. It's also an iridescent snake. So it sort of shimmers as it goes along. It's sort of green and blue, depending on which way you look at it. But it was researchers from the Smithsonian and the Vietnam Academy of Science. And they published their findings in Kapaia. It was last year they found it, but as we've mentioned before, it takes a little while to process these so you can confirm it's a new species. But it is. It's undergone DNA analysis as well. They actually took it back to the Smithsonian, but it will be returned to Vietnam after they have finished their DNA analysis. It's really unusual snake. It's from a group of snakes called the odd-scaled snakes, or the Achelinus. So this genus, there's only 13 recognized species, maybe 10. I don't know taxonomy. But yeah, there's about a dozen recognized species of this snake, and they're called the odd scaled snakes because, unsurprisingly, they have very odd scales. And what's really odd about them is, you know how like when you look at a snake and you go along its body, that its scales overlap? Yeah, theirs don't.
Yeah. Huh. They're like lizards?
Yeah, they're like individual scales in place. They don't overlap at all. So they're quite distinctive as a group of snakes. And they actually probably branched off from other snakes a lot earlier than other groups. So they're probably a really interesting group to study in understanding the evolution of snakes. Problem is, it's not a lot of them. Like I mentioned, there's only about a dozen. They live all over Asia, but they're pretty rare. They live from Japan to sort of Vietnam sort of area. But to give you an idea of how rare, quote from Truong Nguyen, a vice director of the Institute of Ecology and Biological Resources at the Vietnamese Academy of Science. He said, in 22 years of surveying reptiles in Vietnam, I have collected only 6 odd-scaled snakes.
Whoa.
Yeah. Huh. So they're very, very rare and misunderstood. So finding this new one's really exciting. And there's a few weird things about it. So one of the things they noticed about its appearance is that it didn't have any bright light photoreceptors in its eyes. And this suggests it probably burrows underground or beneath leaves. That means that that's probably why we haven't seen it before, because these are really hard to find because of their life cycle. It also means that we don't really know much about any of these snakes and what they really do in the wild. So, yeah, an exciting find.
Sorry, I got distracted looking at pictures of snakes. Pretty. I saw some of the iridescence on them. It's very, very pretty.
Yeah, these ones are beautiful.
Yeah, that is good news. Hopefully, yeah, maybe they can do like a little bit more research, or hopefully this new discovery can maybe offer some of these species a bit more protection then.
Yeah, I did read as well that I can't remember the exact number, but I think of all 13 species up until this point, that there is only one loci of a genome produced for that entire genus.
Oh, so not very
understood
well
at all.
Yeah. Cool. But I think with that, that brings us to the end of our news segment. Thank you guys for sharing your exciting and sad news with us this week. So please join us, listeners, after this short break, where we'll be back with our theme, which this week is all about caves. Hello, listeners. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to talk about our theme of caves. So I thought I would actually kick us off this week and talk about some interesting examples of caves that I found in my research. So the first one that I want to talk about is actually something that's quite close to my home. So it's an Irish cave. It's called the Alawee Caves, and these are caves that are found in County Clare in Ireland, and they're limestone caves. This is a very karst landscape. But something interesting that they found in these caves when they were opening them up for tourism in the 70s, so they discovered bones of bears inside them. So there were animal bones discovered, and a biologist in the university in Galway was able to identify them as bear bones. Several years later, actually in 2018, they did some analysis on these bones, and they found, with radiocarbon dating, they looked at the ages of these bones, and they found that there's actually two bears there. So one was from about 9,000 years ago. So this was the skull. It was probably a sub-adult male. And they think that it was using the cave as its home or den, or perhaps even hibernating there, and then it died. The other bone, which was a tibia bone, a leg bone, is a little bit...
I think it's really good that, like, straight away you got to the bare bones of the issue.
Yes. So the other bone, the other bear, has identified as being about 4,600 years old. And what's interesting with this one is they actually found chop marks on this bone, suggesting that the bear carcass was butchered by humans. What's really cool about this discovery, first of all, it shows that there was bears in Ireland, which I personally think is interesting. But secondly, it shows that this landscape probably would have been forested at the time, because bears wouldn't survive very well in the sort of karst landscape as it is now. So I think that it's cool that we can discover these things from caves. We can learn about the history of a landscape, but we can also learn something about the behavior of these animals, and then also the humans as well that would have been hunting these bears.
What I thought was, particularly relevant and kind of scary in my head is that it sounded like they're not bear fossils. Those were bones.
Yeah, bones, yes. They would have only been about 10,000, 5,000 years old between the two of them. So yeah, they would have been actual bones. But something really interesting about those, Irish brown bears is there was research done a little while ago that suggested that polar bears actually had ancestry in Irish brown bears. But this research has since been found to be, I guess, interpreted incorrectly. So basically what actually is the case is that these brown bears and polar bears would have hybridized with each other. So the populations mixed with each other, but the researchers thought that this meant that all polar bears had originated from Irish brown bears, but actually this isn't really the case. But it's cool. So in the last ice age, polar bears would have had been kind of pushed downwards with the glaciation, and the brown bears probably would have been spread up a little. So their ranges would have overlapped. And even today, where their ranges overlap, hybridization is still seen. So it's kind of an interesting insight into the history of these species.
Yeah. Thanks for taking that little aside.
Another cool cave that I found also is based around some interesting animal behaviors. And these are the Kitum caves. So these are caves in Kenya. And what's interesting about these caves is they're actually been excavated by elephants. So these caves have been chipped away and eroded away by elephant behavior. So they dig at them with their tusks and chip away with their trunks. Do you guys know what resource these elephants might be trying to find in these caves?
Diamonds.
No, not diamonds.
The one true ring.
I think I actually do know.
Yeah, do you?
Is it salt?
Yeah, it is, exactly. They're looking for salt. So they use it as basically a giant salt lick. And other herbivores go there too. Because elephants and other species are herbivores, they require some external sources to get salt into their diet. So that was a cool cave example that I thought, because a lot of caves are usually eroded away by water or other sort of geological processes. But I thought this was a fun example of an animal helping to erode away a cave. Nick, I think you had some interesting cave examples as well to tell us about this week.
Yeah, there were just two that I want to share. I won't talk about Peppersauce Cave, the cave closest to where I grew up. It was very small. But I will talk about Postonia Cave in Slovenia. This was a cave that was discovered in the early 1800s and was the first time that beetles were discovered to be living in a cave. And after the discovery of the first cave beetle, Leptodirus hochenwartii, in 1832, this cave was basically discovered to have a huge amount of endemic life. So species that exist in this cave that didn't exist anywhere else on Earth. This cave was given the nickname the biospeleological mecca, which is a little bit of a mouthful, but we'll go through it. So speleology is the study of caving, or the act of caving. And biospeleology is looking at things that live in caves. So that makes sense. So the biospeleological mecca, it's known because it was sort of known as the birthplace of a new biological science, the speleobiology or biospeleology, because it has a huge number of beetles, spiders, pseudoscorpions, millipedes, centipedes, crustaceans, and snails living inside of it. And you might be thinking, wow, I don't really want to be in a small, enclosed, dark space with any of those things. And you'd be right. but we'll talk about that later when we get to our section on horrifying cave animals. So for now, let me move on from Slovenia into Romania, where we talk about the Movile cave, which is a cave known for its toxic atmosphere. It's not great for humans to go explore in. It's a pretty flat landscape, but once you go into the cave, it's got super high, 100 times the normal atmosphere concentration of carbon dioxide. It has about half of the oxygen in the atmosphere outside, and the water is filled with different minerals and things like sulfuric acid is common in the cave. And you might be thinking, wow, nothing's going to live down there. And how wrong you'd be. This brings me to my first topic of the day that I want to talk about, which is the cave food web. And in some caves, you go down deep, you pass the entrance, and then suddenly you're in total darkness. Darkness like you've never seen before. Have either of you ever been down deep in a cave?
Yes.
Yeah. Not, well, I don't know what deep is, but yeah, I've been in a cave on a school trip.
I mean, deep enough where you go in and you, if you turn off your light, you can't see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that sometimes if I'm in the wrong mood, really freaks me out. And sometimes it's awesome to just like feel like you're in the earth. Like there's the weight around you of the rocks and the mud, and then there's nothing in there, but just you and the drips of the water if you're in a cave with water and, you know, that sort of stuff. But there are things that grow down there, even though plants can't grow with photosynthesis. So one of the main primary food sources inside deep caves is microbial life, and not microbes that are photosynthesizing, but microbes that are chemosynthesizing, things that use minerals in the rocks or water to produce energy. And often what they do is produce carbon dioxide, which is why this cave in Romania has such a high carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere. So these bacteria, there's many different kinds, but they also produce methane, and the byproducts of that methane, apparently it's what's termed a messy process. So the metabolic byproducts that sort of spill out of the bacteria and then are used by other bacteria and fungi. And then as things get bigger, the fungi are then eaten by little creatures. And then you get to the point where there's little wood lice living in the caves or other isopods and crustaceans and arthropods. And they eat the sort of detritus on the bottom of the cave that gets washed in or left over from the bacterial metabolic productions. And then finally, you get things like cave spiders that eat the wood lice, and then things like bigger stuff like fish and salamanders that eat spiders and other things. So then you have your food web that's just based off of something that doesn't have to do with the sun, which I think is really promising for sort of dystopic imagining of the future. Like maybe the sun goes dim and nothing can live, but no problem because there's bacteria that don't need the sun. So nice. Caves are experiment for the future. That's my take on caves.
I once heard that described with thermal vents, where there are those chemosynthesizing bacteria there. And someone described it, if the sun were to suddenly disappear and the earth would be flung into space, they would continue as they were, having never known the sun existed.
So that's pretty interesting that you talked about food webs, Nick, because definitely a challenge living inside caves, given what you're talking about there. Not a lot of nutrients created in this system. There's different types of ways you can classify organisms that live in caves. So Nick mentioned lots of different examples of some animals that you might find in caves, but you can classify them in a couple of different ways. I found a couple of different names when I was researching this, but I think the simplest way I found was these three classifications, and it just helps understand how dependent the animal is on the cave and whether they can live outside the cave or not. There are three categories. So the first is troglozine. So that is from the Greek troglo, which is cave, and zine, which means guest. So these are cave guests. They frequent caves, but they're not really specifically adapted to caves. So actually, I think a lot of characteristic cave animals that we may think of are something that can be grouped in this category. So say bats, bears, skunks, even actually humans, not generally modern humans, but early humans probably would have been living inside caves, using it as shelter and respite from the outside environment.
I knew a guy used to live in a cave.
Do you actually?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Yeah, he lived in a cave in an island. It wasn't Sicily, but I think Sicily has islands. Is that right?
Sicily is an island.
But is there islands to the north of Sicily, like little ones or something like that? I might imagine it. But he lived on an island off Italy in a cave for a while.
Huh. So I take it back. There are humans that live in caves. I'm sorry to those cave-dwelling humans. So the second category is a troglophile, which you may understand the word origin of that. So that is cave lover. So these are animals or organisms that can live in the dark parts of the caves, but they can equally survive just as well outside of a cave. So these are things like cave crickets, different types of arthropods, crustaceans. And the third group, which I think personally is quite interesting for this topic, is a troglobite, and this means cave life. So these are organisms that are specifically adapted to live in caves. So a characteristic of these sort of animals is that they lack pigment. They don't need it. They don't see the sunlight. They also lack eyes because, again, they live in the dark. They don't really need to see, and it's a lot of energy for something that's kind of useless. So a lot of them lack eyes, and they also a lot of the time have special adaptations in order to sense their surroundings. So these might be chemosensory adaptations or electrosensory adaptations. So one cool example of this is the ulm. Something cool that I found out about these is that when they were first found in Slovenia, when people found them, so just to put it in perspective, these are sort of neotonic salamanders. So that means that they still retain their gills. They're quite long and they're sort of pale pinkish because they don't have any pigment. They don't have eyes and they have a very long snout. So they're quite elongated looking salamanders. And so when people found these in Slovenia, they thought that they were like unborn dragons from underground caves, which I think is kind of an interesting tie-in with folklore and things like that. But the ulms have really cool special adaptations that allow them to sense their surroundings because they don't have eyes. They use electrosensory receptors in their face to try and find food. And a lot of this time it would be detritus or other small organisms that live in the caves. And a lot of these cave dwelling animals tend to be kind of sedentary. They don't really move very much because it's kind of a low energy environment, so they tend to limit their movement until they need to.
Yeah, remember we talked about that cave salamander that moved like 10 centimeters in like 20 years or something.
Yeah. So another important thing with cave systems is a lot of the time it's important that these cave guests, they actually provide a lot of nutrients. So say, for example, bat guano is an important nutrient for caves.
Naomi, so yes. Is bat flesh.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I found something amazing in caves relating to bats in the sense that bats get eaten a lot. And this is in Cuba. So this is a group of boa snakes, the Cuban boas, or the Chilobothrus angulifa. This is a type of snake. And like you say, it's a visitor to caves. What was the name? What was the word for that again, Naomi?
A troglozine.
So this is this would be a troglozine snake. Actually, I don't even know if you could really call it that because it doesn't even really go that far into the caves. These snakes have adapted that what they do is they go to the entrance of the caves where the bats have to go in and out because the bats go in there for protection. Because there's not many troglozines, so they're usually quite safe and protected and there's out of the elements, but they have to leave the cave to feed. And then they bring those nutrients into the cave, as you say, in guano. But these snakes have learned this. So what they do is they hang on to the walls of the cave entrance. And in a spring-like motion, they will jump out and grab bats. Now, this is pretty cool, but not the most exciting thing in of itself. You might have even seen it on nature documentaries. It's quite a common thing to film. But what's really cool is fairly recently, there's been a claim that what these are doing is cooperative hunting. Now, this is surprisingly rare. So only 5 to 20% of predators partake in cooperative hunting. We tend to think of it as common because that's something that we do as humans. Things like wolves and lions also do it. Most dogs would. But most predators prefer to hunt in a solitary way, as you would imagine most snakes do. When you think of a snake attack, you don't think of two working together. And even when you see multiple snakes in the same place, like that footage from Planet Earth where they were chasing those iguanas, it's not really seen as a cooperative hunt because essentially they're all just trying to hunt. They're not sort of working together to share the meal or anything. So this chap, Vladimir Dinets, he wanted to look and see what was going on here because what he noticed is that these boas would actually line up pretty close to each other. So he did a test and he noticed that when there was a boa in the cave, whether the next boa would line up near it or far away from it. Because you would think you wouldn't want to go too near it because then you might be competing for the same food. But what he noticed is that they actually, the more boas they were, they would line up next to each other within a certain distance and create sort of a fence, which meant there was nowhere for the bats to go It was creating this fence in the gateway to this cave, which meant that one of them would catch the bat. And this was evidence of cooperative hunting. And this was the first study to test for coordination between hunting and reptiles. And it assumes that there is, it seems to show that there is. There have been previous assumptions based on the previous complexity of hunting behavior of reptiles, but it's never been tested. But this one actually tested it and found out that, yeah, they are coordinated.
That's so cool. Yeah, I wouldn't really think about, particularly, I guess, as well, the way that they eat. I think a lot of the things that I think of as cooperative feeders would like eat the same animal or they'd share. But I suppose when they're helping each other catch prey, that's really cool. Do they show that there was any sort of benefit to, say, one particular spot? Like, do they swap or was it just beneficial just that they were kind of blocking the whole entryway?
Yeah, I don't think that there was like a peak spot they were going for, but it was just that producing this net, if you will, made it much more likely for the bats to get caught. Because if there was a way they could go where there were no snakes, they'd go that way. But if they cover the entrance, then they would spread out as much as possible and all snakes might get to eat.
Does sound like it's an extra challenge to living in a cave, though, trying to survive these snakes jumping out at you. But that isn't the only horrifying thing that you might find in a cave, is it, Nick?
Not even a little bit. That is pretty horrifying, I will say, especially if you're not a snake person. Nick, you've brought us two horrifying snake facts already today. Thanks. Luckily, I had a ball python growing up, so I'm a huge fan of the boas. Venomous snakes, not so much. But there are other horrifying things in caves. So the thing that led me down this particular theme was finding out that you guys have heard of huntsman spiders, right? They're the ones that hunt. That's why they're called that. They don't hunt people, luckily, so not everything's in a name. But there's many different kinds, and the huntsman spider, it's, I think, particularly known from Australia, but there are many that live in the southeast sort of Asian tropical regions, and the average size of huntsman spiders is about an inch long, which I'm reading this thinking, okay, an inch, that's 2.5 centimeters, totally manageable for a spider. Hold on. Oh, with a leg span of up to 5 inches or 12 centimeters. Okay, that's a little more horrifying. And then, but that's average. So there are bigger ones. And the biggest one that's ever been found is I know we're taking a little spider detour here, but bear with me. The giant huntsman spider, which is commonly known as the largest spider in the world by diameter, has a leg span of up to 30 centimeters or 12 inches or a foot, also commonly referred to as the size of a dinner plate, which is too big for me to think about a spider being, but it just might make everything a little bit more palatable, making a pun on the plates there. If you think of where it was discovered, which was in Laos, 2001, in a cave. This spider, the giant huntsman, is a cave dweller, and they only live in caves. And I would not want to have been the researcher who discovered this spider in the cave. Because you're out there thinking, what have we got in this cave? We've got some palms, we've got some bats, we've got some boas, we've got some spiders. Sure, no problem. Oh, what's that over there? Oh, is that a small mammal? No, that's the biggest spider in the world. Oh my God. So no, that's not on my agenda. Thank you. The other thing that came to mind when thinking about horrors of caves is that the sort of cave physiology that things develop over time. They stop putting energy into things they don't need. So things that have been in caves for a long time often lose their eyes. Their skin loses its pigmentation. They often become very thin. They don't move much. Their muscular mass doesn't have to be so strong. They don't do this level of sort of like frenetic moving around. Of course, things that move in and out of caves frequently, like bats, still have to do this. So bats have all of these features. But when you put together things that are slow and creepy crawly and blind and don't move that much and all of this, lack of pigmentation, you add it together. And then you add something I think is really interesting about these cave creatures is that because their metabolism is so slow and they don't move so much, they can live for much longer than their non-cave dwelling relatives. So you get some species of fish and salamanders that can live up to 100 years, which seems like a very long time for a small animal to live. And it's because I think their metabolism slowed down so much. But you get, add all these things together and add to that live for a very long time. And that to me is just Gollum from Lord of the Rings. Like, J.R.R. Tolkien nailed it with Gollum, with the physiology of caves, because everything about him, the like frail, thin, no pigment, giant eyes that can't see very well, and the creepiness, it's all there. So he's like the perfect cave dweller for me. And if you're thinking about, what is the cave dweller supposed to be like again? Oh yeah, those are the features. So just keep that in mind. Another thing that people find creepy in caves are bats. And I just want to say, heck no, we love bats. There is a huge fear of bats. And I think that this fear of things in caves and the fear of the dark in general comes from sort of the fear of the unknown, of the things that you can't see. And the more that we can learn about bats, the better. So revisit our previous episodes where we talked about bats, and maybe one day we'll have a Creatures of the Night or something episode where we'll talk about bats. And I think the last thing I want to talk about is not so horrifying, but is really cool that you can find in caves, just for a little note of lightness, is something that we've left in caves, not trash, not graffiti. Well, actually, graffiti, but really old graffiti. Now, I think it would be nice to talk about cave paintings. Nick, what do you think?
I think that would be a great idea. I do know it's not graffiti, though, because isn't graffiti Italian for scratches?
Good question.
I asked Nick because he speaks Italian. So.
Yeah, graffiti is a weird... That's not a normal word.
No, that was a bit of an unfair question.
It's from Italian, a scratch.
I feel really clever right now.
Nice. Are you secretly an etymologist, not an entomologist?
Yeah, I ironically got the words confused. I'm on the wrong podcast. Yeah. Yeah, so these are not scratches that I was looking at. These are done with pigment. What I was actually looking for was the depictions of animals in caves. And I wanted to find the oldest one. The oldest ones that we found so far are from a cave, a limestone cave, the Liangbulu Sipong 4, number 4, that is, at the end. But these are in Sulawesi in Indonesia. And in these caves, they have several figures, some of which are human, some of which are animal, and some of them are therianthropes, which are transitional forms, not in an evolutionary sense, but in a magical sense, between animals and humans, which may have been some sort of origin myth or some sort of folk tale about people who could change between the two. Using dating, the paintings have been dated. Yeah, the painting, they use a basic uranium series analysis, and they found that they were at least 43,900 years old. They could be upwards of 50,000 years old. So these are staggeringly old. And the animals that they wanted to the animals that they were displaying, we can actually tell what they are. One of them is a wild pig. And the other one is some sort of small, sort of looks like a dwarf water buffalo or an Anoa. Are you guys familiar with the Anoa? I feel like that's an animal that's up your streets. Do you know her, the Anoa?
Yeah, I know the Anoa. I know the Anoa.
Gnomes, so, do you know an Anoa?
I have to look it up, actually, but I am familiar now that I've looked it up.
About 50,000-year-old cave paintings have depictions of this Anoa, and they were, it appears, hunting them. What I really, really like about this is, obviously, at the time, that would have been cutting-edge technology. The reason that this is so important is these figurative stories, is this is the oldest pictorial record of storytelling and the earliest figurative artwork in the world. It's nearly the oldest representation of therianthropes, I think, or maybe it is. There is another one, which is a statue from Germany, which is a half cat, half human. So these are very old ideas, and they still exist. But this is important because that idea of telling a fictional story is believed to be the last cognitive jump in the sort of human psyche. That ability to make stuff up and tell narrative stories would be so, so important for our evolution. And it sort of ties in nicely with what we're doing, because I can't help but feel that this person telling stories and sharing their knowledge about animals by telling other people in the group about what they've learned and what they know is essentially what we do, just with, you know, microphones and, yeah, slightly more complicated technology. I'm really glad I don't have to draw it on a wall because my drawings are terrible. Yeah, I feel like if they were able to record their voices, they'd probably be doing something very, very similar to us and talking about animals to as many people as they could.
Cool. Some animal lovers in the past.
That's a nice comparison. I like it.
Another one of my favourite cave paintings is there's an argument. Yeah, you see those rotoscopes often argued as the earliest animation in the world. Well, there's an argument they might have been beaten by about 32,000 years.
Oh, dang.
So the caves, you know, the Chauvet caves in the south of France, there's very, very, very famous cave paintings. So some of them, what they are is they'll have the body of a bison, but there'll be several pictures overlaid each other. And some researchers think that depending on where you held the flaming torch, a different pose would appear. So if you were to move the torch up and down, what you might see is a buffalo moving its head up and down, or a horse rearing on its hind legs. So what that might actually be is a 32,000-year-old animation.
Amazing.
Wow, that is impressive. And something that is already quite impressive. Something actually I found when I was looking up cave paintings today was that in the Lascaux caves, so they're also French cave paintings, they're quite famous as well. They're from about 17,000 years ago. Something that I didn't know happened with cave paintings is they found evidence of hollowed out bones and twigs. So they think that they may have been using like spray paint. So blowing through these tubes to produce like a spray paint effect with their pigment, which I think is really, really cool.
I remember seeing, I think it was a TV show, Civilizations, the modern BBC one, about the sort of history of creativity in humans. And they often found, they'd found like musical instruments in these caves as well, including this, you know, when you swing a tube around your head and it makes that noise. They'd found one of them that made this really haunting noise, and especially when played in a cave. So that idea that maybe these, the combination of the pictures and the storytelling and the music, like, because they would have had to go quite far into caves to do this. It's not like they were in the entrance. That's why we only discovered them recently. So this journey into the middle of the cave and bringing these musical instruments and bringing sort of, all these devices to help create images, to tell stories, they may have been really ritualistic and a part of a bigger thing that we're not aware of.
Cool. Yeah, the only thing that I really wanted to mention is sort of the opposite direction that you've just gone in, Nick. Whereas, like, this is a really sort of expansion of our understanding of cave painting into ritual and music and animation, and this performance that you're describing is really cool. One of my favorite things that I've learned about cave painting is in the opposite direction, taking something mystical or fantastical and turning it into something like really mundane, something everyday. And it was a study published by Dorothea Bate, the fossil mammal paleontologist in the Natural History Museum. She was the first female scientist employed by the museum in the early 1900s. She published a study about the drawing in the Lascaux caves in France that's supposed to be a depiction of a unicorn. It's like a sort of horse or deer-like creature with an incredibly long horn pointing straight out. Just one. And there's a couple of them throughout, but there's really sort of one specific one that is really beautiful. And she says her hypothesis is that this is actually a depiction of something related to the Tibetan antelope, Panthelops. And if you take a look at these Panthelops, when they are standing in profile, their horns come straight out and they're very dark and dramatic. And they look just like a really long unicorn. And I think it's a really nice sort of like, I think it calls attention to what a lot of these studies on these natural history drawings and cave paintings from 30, 40,000 years ago do, which is to say these people were really looking at the natural world around them and they were seeing it and wanting to capture it in a visual way, in a really faithful way. So a lot of the like biological and morphological details of the animals are captured truthfully and faithfully in a way that I think is really interesting to sort of think like, oh, this knowing the natural world was very important to these people. I don't know, if you asked me to draw a cow or a horse or a Tibetan antelope on the walls of a dark cave, it would look like a child's drawing, especially if I didn't have one to look at right there.
I mean, I suppose they spend a lot of their time hunting them and cutting them up. More time than you do.
That's true. I do spend a lot of time with the bones, but not a lot of time with the live animal.
So that was some lovely discussion on cave paintings and perhaps how what we do is in fact similar to how these early humans depicted animals in caves, perhaps with some interpretation and perhaps trying to be as scientific about it as they can. So I think that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you guys for joining me today in our episode. Come back and join us again next week, where we will actually have a special
Christmas and holiday themed episode, a little bit shorter than our usual episodes. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Do you reckon that's how aliens look at us?
Yeah, jeez, honestly.
Die of thirst already.
No, they're like, okay. Yep, they've made more concrete than there is of the entire life on Earth. So it's only a matter of a couple of decades now. I don't know. Like, okay, they've cut down their plants by half in 120 years.